What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Welcome to my neighborhood, the Avenue. I grew up here, and each week I'll be sharing the sounds and stories of the people that made the Avenue great. Welcome back to the Avenue. On this week's show, we'll be celebrating Juneteenth with a special preview of the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival. It's happening on Saturday, June 18th at the Old National Center. The festival features an all-star lineup including Zapp, Trouble Funk, Average White Band, The Bar K's, Lakeside, and Climax, along with Naptown's own Circle City Band and Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. Over the next hour, we'll look back at our interviews with Circle City Band and Ebony Rhythm. We'll also hear from the concert's promoter, Gino Shelton. Indiana Avenue has a significant connection to Juneteenth. The Avenue hosted the earliest known Juneteenth celebration in Naptown. On June 19th of 1953, an all-star Juneteenth concert was staged at Indiana Avenue's legendary Sunset Terrace nightclub. The event was sponsored by the Black Firemen and Policemen of Indianapolis and was advertised as a fundraiser for local charities. The concert featured a lineup of notable R&B stars, including Johnny Otis, Marie Adams, Mel Walker, and Red Light.
I know a cat named Way Out Willie. He got a cool little chick named Rockin' Millie. He can walk and stroll in Susie Q and do that crazy hand jive too.
Let's start this week's show with a historic Juneteenth recording from Louis Jordan. Jordan performed often on Indiana Avenue during the 1940s. From 1940, this is Louis Jordan singing Juneteenth Jamboree.
I want to tell you a story from way back. Trump on down and dig me, Jack. In 1865, a hefcat started some jive. He said, come on, Gate, and jump with me at the Juneteenth Jamboree. The rhythm was swinging at the picnic grounds, fried chicken floating all around. Everybody there was full of glee at the Juneteenth Jamboree. Trumpets flaring in the air, mellow barbecue everywhere, clarinets moaning in the hall. All the Gates was having a ball. They didn't know how to cut no rug, but all the cats had a gallon jug. Everybody happy as they could be at the Juneteenth Jamboree.
That was Louis Jordan with Juneteenth Jamboree. On this week's show, we're celebrating Juneteenth with a preview of the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival. It's happening on Saturday, June 18th at the Old National Center. Up next, We'll hear music from one of the concert's featured performers. From 1985, this is the Circle City Band with Party Lights.
When the music's playing and everybody's dancing to the beat, when the DJ plays your favorite song, makes you wanna move your feet.
That was the Circle City Band with Party Lights. Circle City Band will be performing at the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival on Saturday, June 18th at the Old National Center. Circle City Band's founder, Paul Thomas, spoke with WFYI's Kyle Long in 2017. He recalled his family's long history on the Avenue and the connection to legendary musicians like Nancy Wilson and Cannonball Adderley. Let's listen to an excerpt of their conversation.
Yeah, so man, you were telling me about your family's relationship with Nancy Wilson and the Adderley brothers, and they weren't, your parents weren't in music. How did they establish these relationships with these musicians?
Okay. Good question. My mother, well, no, actually, this goes back to my grandmother. She knew I don't know how they knew these people, but the Avenue was almost like Harlem. It had with the Madam Walker Casino and the Sunset and all that kind of stuff going on down there. These musicians came to and played on Indiana Avenue. She personally knew, like, Duke Ellington, the Ink Spots. She knew Joe Louis and all of them. They would come there and frequent the Indiana Avenue. So when my mother was a little girl, she was always around them. Jackie Robinson, a lot of the different sports figures and entertainers. Count Basie, Duke Ellington. And, the Ink Spots, have you ever heard of them?
Oh, yeah. I saw them perform when I was a little kid.
They came from here, yeah. So I grew up around them, but also my mom. And my mom grew up around those people. And Uncle Cannonball and Nat, they played with them here at the Walker and all of that kind of stuff. And then they would also do little jam sessions and stuff. So they frequented here. The music scene used to be really deep here. And so anyway, long story short, my mother was a prominent beautician. And she learned right out of Madam Walker School and a couple of other close friends of the family. They were one of the intricate parts of developing the beauty business with coming up with the perms and all that stuff. And a lot of those musicians and people, they came here to actually get their hair done. And so those relationships got developed through that, actually. And even still now, the beauty business and the entertainment business are married, so they were like at the forefront of that.
So your mom worked in that business. Is part of Madam Walker's enterprise, or did she have her own?
No, my mother studied business and graduated from Madam
Walker. What was the name of your mom's business?
My mother, Hazel Thomas at that time, but she married, her name was Hurt, but she had a beauty shop right down there on North and Blake, right where the playground and all that is now for IUPUI and the student housing. My family owned that corner. My uncle and my aunt, my grandmother's brother, and he was also in the liquor business. So he had the liquor store, the prominent liquor store that was right there. And next door was my mother's beauty shop. And then next door we had a little like variety store and our family owned those businesses right down there in the Avenue and Lockfield and all that. So I was around all those people, and even up and coming people like at that time, like Dave Baker and Billy Wooten and the list goes on and on. Harvey and the Blue Tones and all of, and then all of the other bands that I started hanging around like the Vanguards and Amnesty and Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign and all of that. I was around all of that stuff.
And I read somewhere that you were.
I was the only one that started playing though, sure. Out of my family, except for my cousins. They played, but not. I didn't. My little brother, he never played, and my uncles and them, they didn't play either.
I read that you used to run sound, or you were involved in some kind of the technical aspects of those LAMP recording artists you mentioned.
Not LAMP. No, I was too young. I was around them and learning how to play.
Later on, okay.
I went to some of the rehearsals with the Vanguards with Dickie Pearson, and he let me hang around him. But I did. What's the other guy's name? What was that producer? Produced all that stuff.
Herb Miller?
Herb.
Yeah, he ran LAMP, yeah.
Yeah, I was around him. You remember him? He produced all that LAMP record stuff, Amnesty.
He
was kind of like Carl Davis for Indianapolis. That record label was like Indianapolis' little Motown.
Yeah, he was a fireman, and then he ran that on his side business.
The Vanguards, Amnesty.
Avenue
Tony
Rhythm.
Black and the
Revolution,
compared to what? You don't remember that?
Yeah.
That was a cold song there, man, that he had out.
Go to Work. Yeah. Is that the one you're talking about? Yeah.
And I think he did. Did he do James Bell and all them? I don't
James
know,
Bell
that,
never
that
recorded.
Later?
No, they had their own.
Okay,
labels.
Well, I'm getting out of my element now. Yeah. You're the history guy.
So you gravitated towards music independently? No one in your family played?
Well, no. We started playing. Actually, my cousin, I was just talking to him about this the other day. My cousin had, his dad had bought all the instruments. He had drums and guitar and organ in his house. And he took drum lessons, actually. And I started messing around on the guitar and then started meeting other musicians like his brother and Chucky Bush, that used to play with Manchild with Reggie here, and different, just every side of town, every neighborhood had a band that was playing in the garage or in the basement. As a matter of fact, in my neighborhood, four or five garages, like across the street from me, where I grew up at.
What was your neighborhood?
Was Flash Farrell.
Yeah, Flash Farrell from Manchild, Rhythm Machine.
His mama's house over here, right across the street, and mine, you know. And he's coming back, but he was older than me, though, so he was already in these bands that was traveling, like the Rhythm Machine. I remember when they used to come every day, it seemed like, you know, bringing him back and forth in the van, you know what I'm saying, and we'd be in the garage, and he'd be looking at us like, you know, and of course, we didn't know how to play. We knew like one song at a time. We would learn one song and play that song for about 3 days.
What neighborhood were you in, Paul?
And thought we was putting on a concert.
What neighborhood were you in? Where'd you grow up?
Riverside. West Side.
Yeah.
Yep. Riverside Drive, right there across from the golf course.
What was your band called at that time when you were in the garage? You must remember.
The Rhythm Review.
The Rhythm Review, okay.
And that's the, I always say that's my first professional, because we got paid a check from playing the Northwest High School homecoming for $25. For the whole band. That was our first getting paid to play somewhere. We put on a concert.
And that's where you went to high school, right?
Northwest. I went to Northwest, yeah. I got bussed out there back in the 70s.
In this next clip, Paul recalled meeting Lynyrd Skott and Ricky Clark of Circle City Records, who released the Circle City Band's debut single, Magic.
This guy right here came back home. He had been in New York doing, he had gotten signed to Sugar Hill Records, and he brought some new gear that he had got home. And I said, man, I got this studio time down here, man. Come down and hang out. That's where we ended up doing these tracks right here.
Reggie Griffin, for people listening at home.
He brought the drum machine and the vocoder and a keyboard. He had just got a Voyager keyboard and came down there and, That's my kickoff on having my own record out.
So that's how you kind of put your sound together, was through this equipment you had access to through Reggie.
He came and helped me, and now that I think about it, it came back full circle to where it's me and him ended up like in his basement, ended up doing that, and while I was doing that, instead of me shopping it for a record deal, Ricky Clark and Lynyrd Skott were coming down there to rent studio time with the Ty Scott
record label here in Indy.
And Ricky heard that and he said, man, what are you going to do with that music? I said, I'm going to try to get a deal. He said, we're going to put out a secular label. And he asked me, he said, I'm going to talk to Lynyrd about seeing by putting your music out there, would you be interested? Yeah, so they pressed it, and I didn't want it to be called. I didn't know what I was going to call it at the time because it was all me except for some of the stuff that he helped me with. But it was, I didn't want to be like the forefront person like Paul Thomas. I didn't know what I was going to call it. And they were going to call the record label Circle City Records. So I said, well, why don't we just call this Circle City Band? And because I didn't want my name on it as being like the artist, like a solo artist. And I didn't want to be the front man. Matter of fact, I took my voice off of Magic and went back and tried to get some of the Rapture members to help me out in the studio. And Lonnie was the only one that would show up. He was hungry to write songs. And so Lonnie, I said, man, listen to this. I want you to sing on this. Man, you already, that's the song. I said, no, I don't want my voice on there singing lead. I don't like my lead voice. And I don't want to be the lead singer. So he just, but I wanted him to do it in his own swag. And at the time, I wanted that Ohio kind of sound on it, like Ohio Players or Junie or. And Lonnie is a master impressionist. He can sound like anybody. So, but he went in there and just took my melody and then enhanced it with the sound of his voice and did his own thing on there. So,
yeah, when I heard those records and saw the name of the group, Circle City Band, like probably people all over the world, I pictured, you know, a bunch of guys in the studio.
Oh, man, that's exactly yeah. what I was surprised going for. Make it sound like, make it be a band. And if I was doing all the vocals, it wouldn't have been like that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Lonnie was like the icing on the cake, like the David Ruffin out of Temptations or something. You know, yeah. he's a real lead singer. Lonnie's a unsung cat. He's that cat is special now to this day. He sings with the band Downstroke.
So the label Circle City Records, it was a spinoff of a secular spinoff of Ty Scott
yes.
Records, the gospel label based here in Indy, and you ended up releasing a series of 12-inch singles.
They did. I actually didn't know they were going to do it like that. I told them, I said, I have to do a whole album because they wanted it was like they wanted two songs. Ricky Clark wanted to use one song that I had started a rap thing on. He wanted to use that and call it Ricky Clark Company.
So against your will, the label had kind of, you wanted to put out an album of
music? Yeah, I did
music.
A whole album. I did nine songs and
against your will, they cut it up into 12
No, not against my will. I'm not trying to say it like
sure.
that. I said I didn't
Understood.
Know they were going to just like put out, at the time, the 12-inch single was like the popular thing. Mm-hmm. That was like the thing. Like mixtapes are the thing now, the 12-inch single. But I thought they were going to put out Magic like on a 12-inch and then maybe one more and then put out the whole album because that way we could tour. And if everybody liked the songs, you know, we put a band together and perform the whole thing, an actual live band. And they just kept putting out the singles. They did three and I was like, man, so they never released the album. So unfortunately, but I guess time has a way of
yeah,
doing
right.
things. And so I got 30 years later, those records were still out there on the internet and all that other stuff. And this record label contacted me through a series of events that really, I don't know, I couldn't have planned. That stuff came back.
Let's listen to the Circle City Band's classic 1983 single, Magic.
That magic from the sparkle in your eyes makes me realize I know that you're the only one for me. Just like a flash of light, you came into my life just like a fire. You gave me love so strong, a feeling new was burned with desire. You got a power that amazes me.
Echoes of Indiana Avenue will return after this short break. This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. On this week's show, we're celebrating Juneteenth with a preview of the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival. It's happening on Saturday, June 18th at the Old National Center, The festival features an all-star lineup including Zapp, Trouble Funk, Average White Band, The Bar K's, Lakeside, and Climax, along with Naptown's own Circle City Band and Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. The Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival is being promoted by the legendary Naptown DJ and promoter Gino Shelton. Gino recently spoke with WFYI's Kyle Long, and he recalled his history working on the Avenue.
You mentioned the Walker Theater, and I did want to ask you a few questions about the Walker Theater.
Sure.
You have a pretty significant association with them at a time. Every year around Christmas, too, I do a program looking back at the history of the midnight Christmas concerts at the Walker Theater.
Wow, yeah.
And, you know, I go all the way back to the roots of this celebration, and which I think started in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. It has a long history. You were part of the what is to this day the final Christmas concerts at the Walker, I believe in 88 and 89.
Right.
You coordinated all the talent, promoted the event. Tell me about... You know, your involvement with these concerts. I know you're working with Eunice Trotter at the Recorder because this event had been historically sponsored by the Recorder.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your involvement in this and kind of your association with the celebration.
That event is, it's funny that you mentioned that event because I remember it, but I don't. Mm-hmm. It's funny because all I remember was that, you know, they wanted to do something similar to the Apollo. And all I remember was all of these acts through the years that had been already, that they already had, that used to come every year to perform. And I basically, you know, the talent that I had as far as from what little promotion that I was doing, I used that in incorporation with what the Walker already had to create a show. And for some reason, even though I don't remember details about how I did or what I did, I just have a fond memory of it because it was one of those things where you did it and people talked about it. You didn't think about it, but afterwards people went, man, I saw you at the midnight, blah, blah, blah. And it was really weird because, I mean, I've done some pretty big events up until that point. But that particular event, for some reason, it really resonated with a lot of people because it was, I guess, it was family. So a little bit of everybody went. And I didn't really understand the tradition of that event. But it was a really, really cool event. And I just kept thinking that, you know, we're going to make this the Apollo at the Walker. We're going to make this the Apollo of the Mid, which is kind of like the theme now at the new Walker, the Madam Walker Legacy Center. That's kind of our running joke slash theme, is that we're going to become the Apollo of the Midwest. That's going to be, even though they're way more than an entertainment facility, they're about a lot more as far as educational and giving back to the community. But, you know, my angle in it is that I'm going to turn the theater into the Apollo of the Midwest. So, yeah, I mean, that was a great, great event. I mean, and there's been several times that I've been approached about bringing it back.
You got to.
Several times people have asked me, man, just one more time, you know, just try to do it. And I thought about that because Guy Black used to do a talent show, who was another cohort of mine that worked at TLC. He had a great talent show that he used to do that for years. And I told him, man, you need to come back and let's do one together. So, yeah, you never know. Just the concept of a midnight show like that, and it came, I mean, midnight. But, hey, it worked. So, I mean, it worked for years, too. Yeah. So,
during the 50s and 60s, this used to run from midnight to 6 a.m. Was that the case when you were involved?
No.
I think it ended a little earlier.
I think it went from 10 a.m. to midnight. I think we had the earlier version of it. Yeah. We weren't pure in our attempts to recreate that event. But I just remember it being a lot of fun, and I remember being pretty honored to be able to be a part of that.
Yeah, there were some of the legacy performers involved, like, I don't know if you remember these people, King Moses,
absolutely.
Henry Hinch, Josephine Cheatham, Rodney Stepp.
Yep,
but
absolutely.
You brought in the hip-hop era, and I think, like, Tibb Street Posse performed, and some of the B-Boy crews that were popular at that era. Yeah, how was that received, the hip-hop element?
You know, I
at
think
that, time?
You know what, it's funny because Indianapolis loves Indianapolis. So even though it may not have been the genre that they liked, you know, because their grandma was in the audience or their uncle was in the audience, there was some love and support. So that was the great thing about that show as well. You know, in Indianapolis, but also is a very tough market in that we don't, you know, if you're not talented, we're kind of like the Apollo. We don't really, you know, we're not going to give you a lot of love. You know, you got to work for your work for every dollar, concert dollar, ticket dollar that a person spends because they want a show. You know, they're used to getting a show, and every time you perform, they want a show. So.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, you had a pretty significant association with The Walker. You were producing comedy shows in the theater, right?
Yep.
And you were also doing Club Manhattan up in the casino room, right? Was that what it was, yeah, that what it was called?
Your history knowledge is a lot better than mine. I remember I used to throw so much out because I used to go out of town and try to pick up ideas. It was very important for me to try to bring great mm-hmm. ideas to Indianapolis. And the comedy show I did a year after Def Comedy Jam went on the air. And it's funny about the comedy show because it was, I laid in bed and one night next to my wife, and it was in 1993, and I just spent $10,000, which at then was unheard of for to do something like that. I said, "Is this going to work?" And I did two shows, and I only charged $9.99 for the tickets, and the show ended up costing $18,000, and that's exactly what the show grossed, was $18,000. So I ended up having to raise the ticket price $2. But that was the comedy shows actually opened the door for me to really promote. That was the start of G Entertainment. That was the start. The Walker gets a lot of people don't realize that in The Walker is that my first event, 1986, was at The Walker. I met my wife at a party the week before at The Walker. I was married at The Walker. My first major concert event a year after I was married was at The Walker. So I have a lot of ties to The Walker. I love it, and I hate the fact that it's never gotten the kind of mm-hmm. due that it should. And I don't know why, and I don't want to even get into the politics of it. But it's just such history that I'm wearing this shirt now that I got in Nashville at the Nashville Museum, and I went to that museum, man. It was just so beautiful, man. I mean, the music history in that museum, the money that was spent to put those displays together. I was like, man, this is great. I know they're trying to do some similar things at the museum here, but man, I just the Walker is. I mean, it's primed to be something like that. You know, it should be something like that. I mean, it's got that everything needed to bring tourists to the city and talk about the great history of the avenue and all the things that went along with that. So
that was the legendary Neptown promoter Geno Shelton, the organizer behind the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival. The concert is happening on June 18th at the Old National Center. Naptown's own Ebony Rhythm Funk campaign will perform at the festival. Let's listen to a track from their classic 1973 debut album. This is Ebony Rhythm Funk campaign with Get It On.
Do what makes you happy.
That was Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign with Get It On. Ebony Rhythm will be performing at the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival on June 18th at the Old National Center. WFYI's Kyle Long recently spoke with three of the band's founding members, Pam Tanner Davis, Ricky Jackson, and Lester Johnson. In this clip, the band recalled their history on the avenue.
And I did want to ask each of you about how the legacy and history of Indiana Avenue has influenced your lives and careers in music. Lester and Pam, I know this had a pretty significant influence on you. Lester, you told me some of the first gigs you ever played were with Harvey Cook on the avenue.
It was because I'm older than either Pam or Ricky. So for me, it really was my first introduction to playing and getting paid. I played with Harvey at the old Paradise Inn on Indiana Avenue. So the avenue itself was starting to fade, but I was playing at the old Sunset. After hours, I was playing. Well, me and Ricky, by the time you got me, we were still playing at the
Place to Play
and yeah. Fred Douglas, I believe.
Right.
And we were playing at the after hours there. Then the Place to Play was still open. So there were still venues down there that were still open, but some of the venues were starting to shut down, like the Flame, I think, shut down. Mm-hmm. The Missile Room shut down. George's Bar had been shut down. But there were still places down there. So for me, that was my first introduction to playing there. And I played there with the Moonlighters at the Blue Eagle before I went in the Army in the mid-60s, even before I joined the Funk. So I was already playing on the Avenue, and I already had met a lot of the quote-unquote Avenue people, mm-hmm. like Pat's Hotel on the Avenue, Ida Gillis, the record shop, Arlene's House of Music.
Right,
Arlene. We used to run through Ida Gillis on that, because you could go in on Indiana Avenue and you could come out on, I think that's North Street. And we used to run through there just to that was a dare. Like we were in high school. Man, you run through the hallway through the other side. We would run through there, man, and we were just curious as what we see. Mainly, we'd just be a lot of drunk people laying around like this.
Yeah.
They didn't even pay us any attention, but to us, we thought we had done something.
I mean, I think for the Avenue and the Blue Eagle was probably the first time that outside of, I think that might have been before we went to the Place to Play.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess I kind of started there as this band, you know, because I played there at the Place to Play with Cy Jones and them guys back in the 68. Pete's Blue Room on 29th of Central, you know? Yeah, but that's...
Wow.
That's our, yeah, yeah.
Pam, wow. you went to Addicts.
I came in later, a little late. All I remember is Lester telling me, okay, now look, get in here. He said, I want you to sit over here by the bandstand. Okay, yeah. He was very protective. You know, the guys were very protective of me, like at the Blue Eagle, you know. Yeah. And they say, sit over here by the bandstand now, so won't nobody mess with you. And I'm like, I'll be fine, you know. But it helped me grow a little thicker skin, because you never know when something might break out, you know. But they always were very protective of me when we played those places. Yeah.
This neighborhood played a crucial part in your personal history. It was really a training ground for you as a young musician mm-hmm. in many ways. But I think it, you know, shaped both of you as well, and just the group in general, just that legacy, if nothing else. How did you feel about how the neighborhood was kind of dismantled in later years? And now all remnants of the music culture there have essentially been washed away. Any thoughts any of you want to share on how the city has handled that history?
It messed up all the big cities. It messed up Detroit, messed up Atlanta, messed up Indianapolis. From the interstate
urban
system,
renewal, interstate, the whole mix
of
things.
Well, the whole interstate is what did it. When they developed the interstate system, I mean, you know, Eisenhower developed it. It was a 50s thing, and then it fully manifested itself in the 60s. All the neighborhoods, because at that time, most black people lived near downtown areas. They didn't live in a suburban area. Mm-hmm. So when the interstate system came, it came right over by 12th Street,
right.
My
yeah,
house,
I grew up.
33rd and Raider, and all this. So the interstate, I think, had whole lot to do with messing up the Indiana Avenue, messing up a whole lot of black culture, not just here, but in Detroit, Atlanta,
yep. Los
Indianapolis,
Angeles, where
LA,
I live now.
Mm-hmm. Louisville. The interstate system does jack that all up, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Beyond that, beyond the interstate and IUPUI as well, which ended up absorbing a lot of what the interstate yeah. didn't take, what do you make of the city's sort of lack of recognition of what happened there? Do you feel like the city does recognize this? How do you feel about how the legacy is?
The city ignored it because yeah. the city, I think, basically didn't regard the residents of those communities as having much power or influence. So I think as a whole, I'm not trying to demonize anybody, but I think as a whole, they just basically didn't see black families as being that important. Mm-hmm. And I think they just didn't really give much thought about the interstate or whether or not this this land had any value or anything. And they made people think because they couldn't get the redlining, they couldn't get home improvement loans and stuff to keep the properties maintained. And a lot of these people, like our parents, were all like really hardworking blue collar people mm-hmm. that were honest. But they got shortchanged because they weren't regarded to have it. I think the government, should I say the government, but I mean they weren't seen as being important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pam, Ricky, any thoughts you want to share on that? The legacy of Indiana Avenue as it relates to music history and black history in Indianapolis?
I was blown away. I'm going to tell you, the first time I came home, you know, once I moved away, the first time I came home to visit, I was blown away that the Avenue looks like it does now. Because when I left, it was still the Avenue. You know, there
what
was still.
What year was that?
80.
Yeah, okay. I think 80. Yeah. So there were still businesses down there open, you know. And then I came and everything was just so different. It blew me away to see that. You
bad
know?
Or good? On an emotional level, how did it strike you?
Well, it struck me. No, it did not strike a good chord at all. I remember doing shows at the Walker and, you know, and it just... And I remember all the businesses down there, you know, Florsheim Shoes and all the different businesses that used to be down there. And it just, it's, you know, it kind of saddened me to see the changes, you know. I mean, I'm all for, you know, cleaning stuff up and, you know, changes and all of that. But it just took so much of the black history from it. You know, that I've always known it to be, you know, because I mean, since I was a little girl, I remember hearing my mom talk about, you know, the Avenue and the places they, you know, the bars that her and her mm-hmm. friends used to hang out in down there and everything. And
so a lot of great entertainers came play on the Avenue.
Billy Eckstein.
Yeah, on gas, man.
You know,
pretty much anybody you could name
from
20th century music.
Yeah,
Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington.
Yeah, they did. They came down there and played, and then after the show, they go to the after hours and hang out, and you know. Yeah. So it just kind of saddened me to see the changes that had taken place. Because they didn't just remove buildings and businesses, they took history with them as well.
I remember the businesses by name, because to be honest, a whole lot of the business on the Avenue catered to black patrons.
Absolutely.
Remember the pawn shops, the Matus brothers?
Matus, yeah.
Well, they were a pawn shop, but they also sold a whole lot of clothes and musical instruments. And so you could, if you wanted the latest hat, latest suit, high fashion suit, you went to Matus Brothers. Then there was the Golden Nugget Cafe that was a 24-hour cafe that was right on the corner of Indiana Avenue. And I forget what the Golden Nugget, there was Joyner's Chili Parlor, there was Pat's Hotel on one side.
I remember hearing my mom talk about
Pat's
George's
Barbershop
Bar.
Was underneath it. And there was Arlene's House of Soul music. There was Ida Gillis Bar. That was all these businesses. Because that was where, to be honest, a lot of people didn't shop downtown. We used to go down on the Avenue and buy
That's
shoes.
Where a lot of black people bought
their
stuff.
Because if you really wanted something fashionable... You had to go down on the Avenue and find it.
And when the new music hit the streets, gotta go to Arlene's and buy it.
Old speaker, big old 12 or 15-inch speaker over the top of the doorway.
Yep, sure
and so
did.
When the latest songs would come on, especially if they played them on Randy Radio, WLAC, Galton, Tennessee, they would, Arlene would play the latest records, including blues, and on Sunday, did she play gospel? You heard it all, right?
And
there.
That's where black people went to buy their albums and their singles and all their music.
We just heard WFYI's Kyle Long speaking with three of the founding members of Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. the band will perform at the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival on June 18th at the Old National Center. Let's listen to another classic track from Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. From their 1976 album, Watching You, Watching Me, this is 69 Cents. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for tuning in for this special preview of the Indiana Juneteenth Freedom Music Festival. You can meet me here on the Avenue again next week, same time, same place. And you can find the Echoes of Indiana Avenue podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcast. Echoes of Indiana Avenue is written and produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Herman Butch Slaughter.
Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do. Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do. Do. If you will stop and listen, I will tell you a thing or two.